National Public Radio presents a production of the Hollywood Theater of the Year, 2000X. A radio series devoted to stories of the next millennium. Now, here is your host, the award-winning writer and critic, Harlan Ellison.
Our mutual investiture of intellect and attention this time is a bit of a poser for me as your beamish host. In and out, around and about, I've been running dog to the genre of imaginative literature for more than 50 years. I mean, this makes me not an old fart, but a seasoned and wise repository of minutiae and anecdote. Why, I could put you to sleep in an instant with reminiscences of actually carrying on conversations with Skylark Smith, the venerable E.E. Smith, Ph.D., the author of the Lensman books. I could stun into somnolence a police dog with detailed, fraught recollections of Clifford Simic and Hugo Gernsback and Ron Hubbard. But though I've known the great and the near great, the important and the merely self-important, the hemi-semi-demigods of scientifictional stuff, I gotta confess, I never met one of the all-time best, Murray Leinster. His real name, of course, was Will F. Jenkins, and long before I came squalling into the world, he was already a Pulp Fictioneer headliner. His first story, which was The Runaway Skyscraper, was published in the old legendary Argosy magazine in 1919, just after World War I, and he was, poof, just like that, he was a star from the get-go. So that's why, he said, tugging his forelock and looking sheepish, I am hip-deep in the conundrum because I have absolutely nothing intimate or revelatory to tell you about Will F. Jenkins or Murray Leinster, as famous as he was, and he still is. And what's worse, in the vast backlog of reading I've done, thousands and thousands of stories, somehow I just never read Leinster's Mad Planet. It just went under the radar for me. So, bottom line, we're going to both be hearing this one for the first time. Murray Leinster's The Mad Planet.
In his lifetime of 20 years, Burl had never wondered what his grandfather had thought about his surroundings. The grandfather had suffered an untimely, unpleasant end,
which Burl remembered vaguely as a fading succession of screams as he was carried away at his mother's top speed. Burl had rarely thought of the old man since.
Surely he had never wondered what his great-grandfather thought, and there certainly never entered his head such a hypothetical question as what his many times great-grandfather, say, of the year 1920, would have thought of Burl's world.
Burl was a slender young man wearing a single garment twisted about his waist, made from the wing fabric of a great moth his tribesmen had slain as it emerged from its cocoon.
Burl would have been a curious sight to a 20th century man.
His skin was pink, like a child's, and sported little hair. Even that atop his head was soft and downy. His chest was larger than his forefathers, and his ears were capable of independent movement to catch threatening sounds from any direction. The pupils of his large blue eyes could dilate to extreme size, allowing him to see in almost complete darkness.
He was the result of 30,000 years of human adaptation to changes begun in the latter half of the 20th century. Then civilization had been high and apparently secure. Mankind had reached permanent accord, and machinery performed all labor. Men needed only supervise its operation. Everyone was well-fed and well-educated, and it seemed that until the end of time, Earth would be home to a community of comfortable human beings, pursuing their studies and diversions, illusions and truths. Peace, privacy, and freedom were universal. But just when men were congratulating themselves on this new golden age, fissures opened slowly in the Earth's crust, and carbon dioxide began pouring out into the atmosphere. Scientists noted the Earth's increased fertility, but discounted it as the effect of carbon dioxide released by man's burning of fossil fuels. By the middle of the 21st century, it was generally recognized that a new carboniferous period was beginning, when Earth's atmosphere would be thick and humid, unbreathable by man, when giant grasses and ferns would form the only vegetation. As the 21st century closed, the human race began reverting to savagery. The lowlands were unbearable, the air depressing and enervating. Life there became a sickly, fever-ridden existence. All mankind desired the highlands, and men forgot their 2 centuries of peace. They fought destructively, each for a bit of land where he might live and breathe. Then men died of sheer inanition at 1,000 feet. The plateaus and mountaintops were crowded with folks struggling for footholds and food beyond the invisible menace that crept up and up. There was but one solution. The human body would have to inure itself to the poison or face extinction. It finally developed a toleration for the gas that had wiped out entire races and nations, but at a terrible cost. Lungs increased in size to secure the oxygen of life. But the poison, inhaled at every breath, left the few survivors sickly and perpetually weary. Their minds lacked energy to cope with new problems or communicate knowledge.
So, after 30,000 years, Burrow was ignorant of fire, metals, or the uses of stone and wood. A single garment covered him. His language was a meager group of a few hundred labial sounds, conveying no abstractions and few concrete things.
Of the animal world above water, insects alone endured the change. They multiplied and enlarged in the thickened air. The tiniest butterflies of former days grew until their gaily colored wings measured in terms of feet, while the larger emperor moths extended their purple sails to a breadth of yards upon yards.
3 days before, Burl had crouched behind a bulky, shapeless fungus, watching a furious duel between 2 huge horned beetles.
Their jaws gaping wide clicked and clashed on each other's armor. Their legs clashed like cymbals as their polished surfaces ground and struck each other.
Burl had watched until a gaping orifice appeared in the armor of the smaller beetle. It uttered a shrill cry, or seemed to.
The noise was actually the tearing of the horny stuff beneath the jaws of its victorious adversary. The wounded beetle's struggles weakened. At last, it collapsed, and the conqueror placidly began to eat the conquered alive.
After the meal was finished, Burl approached the scene with caution. He hastily seized the detached, sharp-pointed snout of the victim and fled. Later, he inspected his find curiously. The victim had been a minotaur beetle with a sharp, pointed horn like that of a rhinoceros. Burl examined the sharp, dagger-like instrument. Pricked out his finger on the point and flung it aside as he crept to the hiding place of his tribe.
Burl's people herded together in a leaderless group, coming to the same hiding place to share the finds of the lucky and gather comfort in numbers. They numbered only 20, 4 men, 6 women, the rest adolescents and children. They had no weapons. They bashed stones against the limbs of insects they found partly devoured, cracking them open for what scraps of sweetmeat remained inside, but sought safety from enemies solely in flight and hiding.
The next morning, Burl found the horn where he had thrown it, sticking in the flabby side of a toadstool. He retrieved it, and gradually, far back in his mind, an idea began to form. His imagination began to work fitfully. He visualized himself stabbing food as the larger beetle had stabbed the former owner of the weapon he now possessed. He thought, where was their food? Food that lived, that would not fight back. Presently, he rose and made his way toward the tiny river.
150 yards downstream, an outcropping of rock made a steep descent to the river, from which shelf fungi stretched out. Dark red and orange above, light yellow below, they formed a series of platforms above the smoothly flowing stream.
Burl moved cautiously towards them. En route, he saw one of the edible mushrooms that formed most of his diet, and paused to break from the flabby flesh an amount that would feed him for many days.
Often, his people would find a store of food, carry it to their hiding place, then gorge themselves for days, eating, sleeping, until all was gone.
Burl was tempted to abandon his plan. He would give Saya of this food, and they would eat together. Saya was the maiden who roused unusual emotions in Burl when she was near. Strange impulses to touch and caress her. He did not understand. He went on, after hesitating. If he brought her food, Saya would be pleased. But if he brought her of the things that swam in the stream, she would be more pleased.
Degraded as his tribe had become, Burl was yet a little more intelligent. He was an atavism, a throwback to ancestors who had cultivated the earth and subjugated its animals. He had a vague remnant of pride, unformed, but potent.
He reached the rocky outcropping and lay prostrate, staring into the water's shallow depths. A huge crayfish, as long as Burl, leisurely crossed his vision.
Small fishes and even huge newts fled before the voracious creature. Eventually, the tide of underwater life resumed its activity. The wriggling dragonfly grubs reappeared. Little flecks of silver swam into view, a school of tiny fish. A larger fish appeared, moving slowly.
Burl's eyes glistened. His mouth watered. He reached down with his long weapon, barely touched the water. Disappointment filled him, yet the nearness and apparent practicability of his scheme spurred him on. He considered the situation. The shell fungi were below him. He rose and moved to a point just above them, then thrust his spear down.
They resisted its point.
Burl tested them tentatively with his foot, then dared to trust his weight to them.
They held firmly.
He clambered onto them and lay flat, again peering over the edge.
The large fish, as long as Burl's arm, swam slowly to and fro below.
Burl had seen the former owner of his spear strive to thrust it into an opponent. So when the fish swam by, he thrust it sharply downward. To Burl's astonishment, the spear seemed to bend where it entered the water and missed its mark by inches. He tried again and again. He grew angry with the fish. Repeated strokes had left it untouched, and it was insultingly unwary, not even trying to flee. Finally, the fish stopped directly beneath his eyes. Burl thrust straight down with all his strength. This time, the spear entering vertically did not seem to bend. Its point penetrated the scales of the swimmer below, transfixing that lazy fish completely.
An uproar began, the fish struggling to escape,
and Burl trying to draw it up to his perch. Excited, he failed to notice an ominous approaching ripple on the water. Then there was a tremor in Burl's support. It gave way. Falling into the stream with a mighty splash, Burl submerged, eyes wide open, facing death. As he sank, he saw waving before him the gaping claws of the huge crayfish, large enough to sever a limb with one stroke of their jagged jaws. Burl was sure he would die, for he could not swim. The only question was whether he would drown or be devoured first.
But the section of the shelf fungus that had collapsed beneath him was lighter than water. It rapidly surfaced.
With Burl still on top.
The crayfish, deprived of its prey, wandered off.
He finally recovered his self-possession and looked for his spear. It was floating in the water, still transfixing the fish whose capture had endangered Burl's life. The fish now floated lifelessly, belly upward. Burl forgot his predicament upon seeing this prey just out of reach. He gazed at it, mouth watering, while his cranky craft went downstream, spinning slowly in the current. He hastened to the edge of the raft. It tilted and nearly flung him overboard. Experimenting, Burl soon found that it remained stable if he lay flat across it. He wriggled into position and waited until the slow revolution of his vessel brought the spear shaft near. He stretched his fingers and arm and grasped it. A moment later, he was tearing strips of flesh from the fish and cramming the oily mass into his mouth with gusto. He had lost his edible mushroom, yet Burl ate contentedly of what he possessed. He happily visualized the delight with which Saya would receive a gift of part of the fish he had caught. Burl suddenly realized he was being carried farther and farther from Saya. Stricken with dumb sorrow, he lifted his head and looked longingly at the riverbanks. Presently, Burl ate again of the oily fish. The taste pleased him, a rare break from his diet of insipid mushrooms. He stuffed himself, though the size of his prey left most uneaten. He next stripped a sinew from the garment about his middle and hung the fish from his neck with it. That left him both hands free.
Time passed and sunset grew near.
Homesick, he lay on his floating atom all night. At last, the mushroom raft struck gently and remained grounded on a shallow in the stream. At daybreak, Burl gazed keenly about.
He was 20 yards from shore, and the greenish scum surrounded his now disintegrating vessel. The river had widened until the other bank was barely visible through the haze above the surface, but the nearer shore seemed firm and no more dangerous than the territory his tribe inhabited.
He found himself in another toadstool forest and finally paused. He recognized the type of fungus growths around him and began eating voraciously. In Burl, the sight of food always produced hunger, nature's compensation for his lack of an instinct to store food. Burl's heart was small within him. He was far from Saya and his tribe.
Just 40 miles separated them.
But Burl did not think of distances. He had come down the river. He was alone in a land he had never known or seen.
Food was plentiful. The mushrooms surrounding him were edible, a supply of sustenance Burl's whole tribe could not have eaten in many days.
But that very fact made him think of Saya. He suddenly remembered the large, oily fish he had caught for her, still hanging down his neck from the sinew about his neck. He took it and fingered it all over, getting his hands and himself thoroughly greasy in the process. But he could eat no more. The thought of Saya's pleasure at the sight of it gave him renewed determination.
Overconfidence now possessed Burl.
He walked less cautiously, more boldly. The fact that he had struck something and destroyed it lent him foolhardy courage. He climbed to the top of a red clay cliff, 100 feet high.
From a point halfway up the cliff, the inch-thick cable of a spider's web stretched down to an anchorage on the ground. The geometrical pattern of the web glistened evilly. Somewhere among the cliffside fungi, the huge creature waited until some unfortunate prey would struggle helplessly in its monster snare. The spider waited, motionless, implacably patient, invincibly certain of prey, utterly merciless to its victims.
Burl strutted at the cliff's edge.
A silly little pink-skinned creature with an oily fish slung about his neck, a draggled fragment of moth's wing about his middle, and a beetle's nose in his hand.
He looked scornfully down on the whitely shining trap. He had struck mushrooms, and they had fallen before him. He feared nothing. He knew the spider would not leave its web to attack. Using his spear, he shoved a chunk of fungus growing at his feet down the cliffside into the colossal web.
The black bulk of a hidden spider swung out to investigate.
Burl kept pace with it, knocking more lumps of shelf fungus loose and laughing as they narrowly missed the confused black and silver creature. Then
the trap door clicked faintly and Burl whirled. His laughter became a scream. Approaching with incredible speed, the monster tarantula opened its dripping jaws, mandibles gaping wide, poison fangs unsheathed. The creature was 30 paces away, 20, 10. It leaped into the air, all 8 legs extended to seize.
Still screaming, Burl thrust out his arms to ward off the impact. In his terror, his grasp on his spear became agonized. The spear point shot out and the tarantula fell on it.
Nearly a quarter of the spear entered the body of the ferocious thing. Transfixed on the spear, the monster writhed nightmarishly, still struggling to reach Burl,
who himself was transfixed with horror.
Mandibles clashed. Awful sounds came from the beast. One of the attenuated, hairy legs grasped across Burl's forearm.
He instinctively stepped backwards, off the edge of the cliff.
Down through space, eyes glassy with panic, the two creatures, man and skewered tarantula, fell together. With a strangely elastic crash and crackling, they hit the web below.
Burl could be no more fearful. Struggling madly in the gummy coils of an immense web, ever binding him more tightly, with the wounded creature still striving to reach him with poison fangs, Burl had reached the limit of panic. He fought madly to break the coils about him. His arms and breast were greasy from the oily fish. The sticky web did not adhere to them, but his legs and body were inextricably fastened by the elastic thread spread for just such prey as he. He paused, exhausted. Then he saw, 5 yards away, a silvery and black monster waiting patiently for him to tire.
It judged the moment propitious. The tarantula and man were one in its eyes, one struggling thing that had fallen opportunely into its snare. They moved, but feebly now, The spider advanced, delicately, swinging its huge bulk nimbly along the web, playing out a cable after it, coming inexorably closer.
Burl's arms were free because of the greasy coating they had received. He waved them wildly, shrieking at the approaching pitiless monster.
It paused.
Burl felt the cables of the web give slightly
as the spider approached to sting and suck the sweet juices from its prey.
Burl froze in an ecstasy of terror, waiting for poisoned fangs to be thrust into him. He knew the process, having seen the leisurely way giant spiders delicately stung their prey, then withdrew to wait patiently for the venom to take effect.
The bloated, evil creature moved meditatively about the shining sheets of silk it had cast over Burl and the giant tarantula. Now, only the tarantula moved feebly. Its body, outlined by a bulge in the concealing shroud, throbbed faintly as it struggled with the spear in its vitals. The rounded protuberance offered an obvious target. The web spider moved quickly forward and stung. Galvanized into fresh torment by this new agony, the tarantula writhed in a very hell of pain. Its legs struck out purposely in horrible gestures of delirious suffering.
Burl screamed as one touched him and struggled himself. His arms and head were both free beneath the silken sheet because of the grease and oil coating them. Striving to escape his deadly neighbor, Burl clutched at the threads about him
and did not break but parted. And a tiny opening appeared. One of the tarantula's attenuated limbs touched him again.
With the strength of utter panic, he hauled himself away.
The opening enlarged.
Burl's head emerged into open air and stared down 20 feet on an open space carpeted with spiky shards of his captor's former victims. Burl's head, breast, and arms were free, but his lower body was held firm by a gummy snare far more tenacious than any bird lime ever manufactured by man. He hung a moment in his tiny window, despairing. He saw, at a little distance,
the monster spider waiting patiently for its poison to take effect and the struggling of its prey to cease. And the tarantula was weakening, only shuddering now.
Burl withdrew his head and thrust desperately at the sticky stuff about his legs and loins. The oil in his hands kept it from clinging to them, and it gave it. In a flash of inspiration, Burl understood. He reached over his shoulder and grasped the greasy fish, tore it in a dozen places, and smeared himself with the now rancid exudation, pushing the sticky threads from his limbs and oiling the surface from which he had thrust it. He felt the web tremble.
To the spider, its poison seemed to have failed. Another sting seemed necessary. It would again inject its deadly venom where the disturbance was manifest, into Burl.
He gasped and drew himself toward the window. It felt as if he was pulling his legs from his body. His head emerged, his shoulders. Half his body was outside the hole. He shot through the opening and fell sprawling to the earth below, crashing onto the shrunken shell of a flying beetle which had fallen into the snare and had not escaped. Burl rolled over and over, then sat up. Burl ran a few hundred yards and stopped. It behooved him to move carefully. Even the most familiar territory was full of unexpected dangers. Unknown lands such as these were doubly perilous. Burl, too, found difficulty in moving. The glutinous stuff from the spider's snare still stuck to his feet, picking up small objects as he went. Old ant-gnawed fragments of insect armor pricked him even through his toughened soles. He removed them, took a dozen steps, and had to stop again.
Burl's brain had been uncommonly stimulated lately. It had gotten him into at least one predicament, due to his invention of a spear, but extricated him from another. Reason had led him to oil his body to escape the spider's snare.
Cautiously, Burl looked about him. He seemed safe. Then deliberately, he sat down to think.
Never in his life had he done such a thing. His tribesmen were not given to meditation, but a powerful idea had struck Burl, an abstract idea.
When he was in difficulties, something within him seemed to suggest a solution. Would it do so now? He puzzled over the problem. Sharp pebbles, remnants of insect armor, and other things hurt his feet when he walked. They always had, but never had his feet been sticky so that the irritation continued with him more than one step. He gazed at his foot and awaited inspiration. Meanwhile, he slowly removed the sharp pointed fragments one by one. Partly coated with a half-liquid gum from his feet, they clung to his finger, except where the oil was thick.
Burl's reasoning before had been simple and of primary order. Where oil covered him, the web did not. Therefore, he would coat the rest of himself with oil. But to apply knowledge gained in one predicament to another difficulty was something he had never done. Imminent peril had stirred Burl to invention. That was extraordinary enough. But reasoning in cold blood, as he did now, that
oil on his feet would nullify the glue there and enable him to walk in comfort,
that was as much a triumph of intellect as any masterpiece of art in the ages before.
He oiled his feet.
It was an infinitesimal problem, but Burl's struggles with the mental process of reasoning were real. He was teaching himself how to think. And with touching faith in his new pastime, Burl sat down again and knitted his brows. His questions were easily answered.
He was naked. He would fashion garments. He was weaponless. He would find a spear. He was hungry. He would seek food. He was far from Saya and his tribe. He would go to them.
Puerile reasoning, of course, but valuable, because it was conscious reasoning, conscious appeal to his mind for guidance, deliberate mental progression from desire to resolution. Even in the high civilization of ages before, few men had really used their brains. The great majority had depended on machines and leaders to think for them. Burl, however, was developing the habit of thinking. A leadership quality, and an invaluable asset to his little tribe.
He stood again and faced upstream. Here and there, Burl saw various flies, some no longer than his thumb, others the size of his whole hand.
They fed on juices dripping from maggot-infested mushrooms when filth more to their liking was unavailable. Far away, a shrill roaring sounded faintly. It was like multitudinous clickings blended into a single sound, but it was so distant that it did not gain Burl's attention. He had all the strictly localized vision of a child. What was near was important. What was distant could be ignored. Had Burl listened, he would have realized that army ants were abroad in countless millions, deploying themselves in a broad array and wreaking greater destruction than so many locusts. Burl did not notice the sound, however. Preoccupied,
he moved forward, briskly though cautiously, searching for garments, food, and weapons. He confidently expected to find them all shortly. Surely enough, he found a thicket of edible fungi just half a mile beyond the spot where he had sat down to think. Burl tugged at one end and broke off a piece. Nibbling as he went, he entered a broad plain over a mile across, broken into odd little hillocks, by gradually ripening and suddenly developing mushrooms with which he was unfamiliar. Their rounded, blood-red protuberances forced aside the earth as they grew.
Behind, a high, shrill roaring grew slightly louder,
but remained too far away to impress Burl.
The army ants were wreaking havoc in the distance. By millions, they were foraging the country, climbing every eminence, descending every depression, antennae waving restlessly, mandibles extended threateningly. The ground was black with them, each 10 inches long. A single such creature would be formidable to an unarmed, naked man like Burl, whose wisest move would be flight. But in numbers, they represented a menace from which escape seemed impossible. They advanced steadily and rapidly amid shrill stridulations and multitudinous clickings.
Meanwhile, Burl was inspecting the rent and scraped remains of a great beetle's shiny casing lying on the ground. A greater beetle had met it first and slain it. The best he could find was a fiercely toothed hind leg. He picked it up and went on, swinging the toothed limb in his hand. Accustomed to using stones to crush the juicy legs of the giant crickets his tribe sometimes scavenged, he formed a half-defined idea of a club. The sharp teeth of the thing in his hand made him realize that a sidewise blow was better than a spear-like thrust.
The sound behind had become a distant whispering, high-pitched and nearer. The army ants swept over a mushroom forest, and the yellow branching tree-like growth swarmed with black creatures devouring the substance to which they clung.
A great blue-bottle fly, shining with metallic luster, reposed in an ecstasy of feasting, sipping through its long proboscis the dark-colored liquid that dripped slowly from a mushroom. Burrow drew near and struck. The fly collapsed into a writhing heap. Burl stood over it, pondering.
A quarter mile to the left of Burl's line of march, and a mile behind the spot where he stood over the dead fly, was an acre-wide stretch where giant, rank cabbages had so far resisted the encroachments of the ever-present mushrooms. The pale, cross-shaped cabbage flowers fed many bees, while the leaves fed numberless grubs, worms, and loud-voiced crickets, which crouched about on the ground, munching busily at the succulent green stuff. The army ants swept into the green area, ceaselessly devouring all they encountered. A terrific din arose. The crickets hurtled away in a rocket-like flight, a dark cloud of wildly beating wings. They shot aimlessly in any direction. Half fell into the black tide of devouring insects. They were seized instantly. They uttered terrible cries as they were torn to bits. Horrible, inhuman screams reached Burl's ears.
Individual cries of such agony were too commonplace to attract Burl's attention, but the chorus of tormented creatures made him look up. This was no minor horror, but wholesale slaughter. He peered anxiously toward the sound. From where he stood, Burl could see three great grubs in lazy contentment eating ceaselessly the cabbages on which they rested.
Suddenly, first one and then another began to jerk spasmodically. About each, a rim of black appeared. Tiny black motes milled over the cabbages' green surfaces. The grubs and cabbages became black. Horrible contortions of the writhing grubs bespoke their agonies. Then, a black wave appeared at the further edge of the stretch of sickly yellow fungus, a glistening, living wave moving forward rapidly with a roar of clickings and a persistent overtone of shrill stridulation.
The hair rose on Burl's head. He knew all too well the meaning of that tide of shining bodies. With a gasp of terror, intellectual preoccupations forgotten, he turned and fled in ultimate panic.
And the tide came inexorably on.
In a moment, the Hollywood Theater of the Ear will return with the conclusion of The Mad Planet. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Host, Harlan Ellison.
And now, Act Two of The Mad Planet by Murray Leinster.
Clinging desperately to a sharp-toothed club, Burl darted through the tangled aisles of the little mushroom forest with heedless disregard of the dangers that might await him there. Flies buzzed about him loudly, huge creatures glittering with metallic luster.
One struck him on the shoulder, tearing his skin with vibrating wings.
Burl thrust it away and sped on.
The oil covering him had turned rancid, and the odor attracted these connoisseurs of the fetid.
A heavy weight settled onto his head, then doubled.
Two of the creatures had dropped into his oily hair to sip the rancid oil through disgusting proboscises.
Burl shook them off with his hand and ran madly on. His ears were keenly attuned to the sounds of the army ants behind him, and it grew little fainter.
The clicking roar continued, but the buzzing of flies began to overshadow it. In Burl's time, flies had no great heaps of putrid matter in which to lay eggs. Ants, those dizzy scavengers, carted all carrion away long before it acquired the gamey flavor beloved by fly maggots. Only in isolated spots were flies really numerous, but there they clustered in clouds that darkened the sky. Such a buzzing, turbulent cloud surrounded the madly running figure of Burl. It seemed as though a miniature whirlwind of winged bodies and multifaceted eyes kept pace with the little pink-skinned man.
He twirled his club before him,
and almost every stroke connected with a thinly armored body which collapsed in a spurt of reddish liquid.
Pain like a red-hot iron struck Burl's back.
One of the stinging flies had thrust its sharp-tipped proboscis into his flesh to suck blood.
Burl yelped and ran full tilt into the thick stalk of a blackened, draggled toadstool.
There was a crack as of wet punk or brittle, rotten wood. The toadstool collapsed with a sickening splash. Many flies had laid eggs in the fungoid, and it was a teeming mass of corruption and ill-smelling liquid. As the toadstool's head crashed to the ground, it fell into a dozen pieces, and the earth for yards around was splattered with a stinking liquid in which tiny, headless maggots twitched convulsively. The buzzing of the flies took on a satisfied note, and they settled by hundreds about the edges of the foul pools, becoming lost in frenzied feasting.
While Burl staggered to his feet and darted off again,
now he was but a minor attraction to the flies. From every direction, they hurried to the toadstool banquet.
Burl ran on. He passed beneath the wide-spreading leaves of a giant cabbage. A great grasshopper crouched on the ground, tremendous jaws crunching on the rank vegetation voraciously. Several huge worms ate steadily from their resting places among the leaves. One had slung itself beneath an overhanging leaf, which would have thatched a dozen huts for men, and was placidly anchoring itself in preparation for the spinning of a cocoon in which to sleep the sleep of metamorphosis.
All, even the mighty grasshopper, would soon be torn to myriad mouthfuls and devoured by the great black tide of relentlessly advancing army ants. The clicking roar of their advance overwhelmed all other sounds now.
Burl ran madly, breath coming in great gasps, eyes wide with panic. Alone of all the world about him, he knew the danger behind.
The creatures he passed went about their business with the terrifying efficiency of the insect world.
Burl's heart pounded madly. The breath whistled in his nostrils.
Behind, the wave of army ants grew nearer. They met the feasting flies. Some took flight and escaped, but those too engrossed in their delicious meal were seized and vanished into tiny maws. The twitching little maggots, stranded on the earth by the shattering of their soupy broth, were likewise torn to pieces. The serried ranks of black insects went on. Combined, the tiny clickings of their limbs, the stridulations of the creatures, the agonized cries of their victims, and the rending of fungi, cabbages, flesh, and chitin produced a deafening din.
Burl was putting forth his last ounce of strength. His limbs trembled. His breathing was agony. Sweat dripped down his forehead. The little naked man ran for his insignificant life as if his continued survival among the million tragedies of that day were the purpose for which the whole universe existed. He sped across an open space 100 yards long. Burl burst through the golden thicket and attacked the ascent. His feet sank into the spongy hillock. Panting, gasping, he staggered across the top. He plunged into a little valley on the farther side up another slope. 10 minutes he forced himself on, then collapsed in a little hollow, still gripping his sharp-toothed club. He lay motionless, breathing in great gasps, limbs stubbornly refusing to move.
Above, a bright yellow butterfly with a 30-foot wingspan fluttered lightly. The sound of the army ants grew nearer.
He crawled painfully to the top of the slope and looked back. The hill crest on which he stood was higher than those he had passed earlier, and he could see clearly the whole purple range. He had nearly reached the farther edge of the range, which was here half a mile wide. A thin, dark cloud had gathered overhead. To the right and left, Burl saw the hills fading into the distance, growing fainter in the haze. He saw, too, the advancing cohorts of army ants creeping over the tangled mass of fungus growths. They fed as they went on the fungus that had gathered into these incredible monstrosities.
Far to the right, the vapor thickened. A column of smoke arose. What Burl did not know, and would never know, was that far down in the interior of that compressed mass of fungus, slow oxidation had been occurring. The temperature of the interior had risen. In the darkness and dampness, deep inside the hills, spontaneous combustion had begun. There had been no flames because the surface remained intact and nearly airtight. But when the army ants began tearing at the edible surface, despite the heat they encountered, fresh air found its way to the smoldering masses of fungus. Slow combustion became rapid combustion. Dull heat became fierce flames. The slow trickle of thin smoke became a huge column of thick, choking, acrid stuff that set the army ants into spasms of convulsive writhing. Flames burst out from a dozen points. Columns of blinding smoke rose skyward. A pall of fume-laden smoke gathered above the range of purple hills, while
Burl watched apathetically, and the serried ranks of army ants marched into the widening furnaces.
30,000 years without danger from fire had extinguished their racial fear of fire. They marched into the blazing orifices they had opened in the hills, snapping their mandible at the leaping flames, springing at the glowing tinder. The blazing area widened as the purple surface was undermined and fell in. The black wave of army ants was sweeping into the fire, into the incredible heat of that carbonized material burning with an open flame. At last, there were only the little bodies of stragglers from the great ant army scurrying here and there over the ground their comrades had denuded of all living things. The entire main army had vanished, burnt to ashes in the furnace of the hills.
Burrow limped over the hills. Twice he saw small groups of army ants. They had passed between the widening surfaces their comrades had opened and were feeding voraciously on the hills they traversed. Once, Burrow was spied, and a shrill war cry sounded, but he moved on and the ants were busy eating. A single ant charged. Burrow brought down his club, and a writhing body remained to be eaten later by his comrades. Burrow emerged from the range of mushroom hills as night fell.
Utter blackness covered the whole mad land, save where luminous mushrooms shed pale light, and fireflies the length of Burl's arm shed fitful gleams on a jungle of fungus growths and monstrous insects. From the sky, now a drop and then a drop, the nightly rain began.
The ground was hard beneath Burl's feet. He picked his path with his large blue eyes, pupils expanded to great size, and listened keenly for sounds of danger.
Something rustled heavily in a thicket of mushrooms 100 yards away. There were the sounds of preening and of delicate feet padding on the ground. The throbbing beat of huge wings began suddenly, and a body lurched into flight. A fierce, downward air current smote Burl,
and he looked up in time to catch the outline of a huge moth passing above. He turned to watch its line of flight and saw a strange glow in the sky behind him.
The mushroom hills still burned.
He crouched beneath a squat toadstool to wait for dawn.
Slowly, slowly, the sodden rainfall continued, drop by drop, all night long. Warm pellets of liquid fell from the sky. They boomed against the hollow heads of toadstools and splashed into the steaming pools that lay festering all over the fungus-covered earth. And all night long, the great fires grew and spread in the mass of already half-carbonized mushroom. The flare at the horizon intensified.
Eyes wide and full of wonder, Burl watched it grow nearer. He had never seen flame before. The flames brightened the overhanging cloud. Burl saw a great peacock moth soar above the burning mushroom hills. Its wings were 40 feet across and fluttered like gigantic sails as the moth gazed down at the flaming furnace. Burl saw it dive straight into the thickest and brightest of the licking flames, flying madly, eagerly into the searing hellish heat. A willing, drunken sacrifice to the god of fire. Burl saw strange collisions and stranger meetings. Male and female flying creatures circled and spun dances of love and death in the wild radiance from the funeral pyre of the purple hills. They mounted higher than Burl could see, drunk with ecstasy of life, then descended to plunge headlong to death in the roaring fires below. A continual faint hiss penetrated the sound of fire.
Raindrops turning to steam. At last the sky grew dimly gray, then brighter, and day began. The flames of the burning hills grew faint as the fire died, and at last
Burl crept from his hiding place and stood erect. He turned to continue his odyssey and saw the remains of one of the tragedies of the night. A huge moth had flown into the flames, been horribly scorched, and floundered out again. Unable to return to its devouring deity, it now lay immovable. One beautiful, delicate wing burned in gaping holes, eyes dimmed by flame, and exquisitely tapering limbs crushed by the force with which it had struck the ground. It lay helpless, only its broken antennae moving restlessly, painfully. Burl approached and picked up a stone. He moved on presently, a velvet cloak across his shoulders, gleaming with all the colors of the rainbow. A gorgeous mass of soft, blue moth fur covered his middle, and bound to his forehead were 2-yard-long golden fragments of the moth's magnificent antennae. In a strip of sinew about his waist was thrust the fiercely toothed limb of a fighting beetle. He soon added to his inventory a sharp-pointed spear from another scorched victim of the flames. It was longer than he himself. So equipped, Burl resumed his trek to Saya.
He was a strange sight, moving cautiously through the shadowed lanes of the mushroom forest. Against the play of color from his borrowed plumage, his pink skin showed in odd contrast. He looked like some proud knight walking slowly through the gardens of a goblin's castle. But he was still a fearful creature, superior to the monsters about him, only in the possession of latent intelligence. He was weak, and therein lay his greatest promise. 100,000 years before, his ancestors had been forced by lack of claws and fangs to develop brains. Burl was, in comparison, vastly more weak than his forebears had been. That weakness would someday lead him and those who followed him to heights his ancestors had never known. But now
he heard a discordant, deep bass below, from a spot not 20 yards away. In a flash of panic, he darted behind a clump of mushrooms and hid, panting in sheer terror. The bellow came again, this time with a querulous note. Burl heard a crashing and plunging as of a struggle. A mushroom broke with a brittle snapping, and the spongy thud as it fell was followed by a tremendous commotion. Something was desperately fighting something else, but Burl could not identify the combatants. The noise gradually faded. Presently, Burl's breathing slowed, and his courage returned. He stole from his hiding place and would have retreated, but something held him back. Instead of creeping from the scene, he crept cautiously toward the source of the noise. He peered between two cream-colored toadstool stalks and saw the cause of the noise.
A wide, funnel-shaped snare of silk was spread before him, 20 yards across and equally deep. Individual threads were plainly visible, but in the mass it seemed a fabric of sheerest, finest texture. Supported by tall mushrooms, it was anchored to the ground below and drew away to a tiny point through which a hole led to some unknown recess. And all the space of the wide snare was hung with threads, fine, twisted threads, no more than half the thickness of Burl's finger. This was the trap of the labyrinth spider. Not one of the interlacing threads was strong enough to hold the feeblest prey, but they numbered in the thousands. A great cricket had become entangled in the maze of sticky lines, its limbs thrashed out, smashing the snare lines at every stroke, but at every stroke, meeting and becoming entangled with a dozen more. It struggled mightily, emitting at intervals its horrible, deep bass cry. The opening at the rear of the funnel-shaped snare darkened. The snare drew itself into a tunnel there, in which the spider had waited and watched. Now it swung out lightly, advancing toward the cricket. It was a gray spider, with twin black ribbons on its thorax, aside the head, and two stripes of speckled brown and white on its abdomen. Burl also saw two curious appendages like tails. The cricket struggled only feebly now, its cries muted by the confining threads fettering its limbs.
Burl saw the spider throw itself at the cricket and witnessed the final convulsive shudder of the insects as the spider's fangs pierced through its armor. The sting lasted a long time, and finally Burl realized the spider was feeding, sucking the succulent juices from the now dead cricket.
When at last the carcass was drained, the spider pawed the lifeless creature for a few moments and left it.
A sudden thought came to Burl and took his breath away. For a second, his knees knocked together in self-induced panic. He watched the gray spider carefully with growing determination. He, Burl, had killed a hunting spider at the Red Clay Cliff. True, the killing had been accidental and had nearly cost him his own life, but he had killed a spider of the most deadly kind. Now great ambition grew in Burl's heart. His tribe had always feared spiders too much to study their habits, but they knew a few things. The most important, snare spiders never left their lairs to hunt. Never. Burl hoped to make daring application of that knowledge. He drew back from the white, shining snare and crept softly to the rear.
The fabric gathered itself to a point and continued 20 feet as a tunnel in which the spider would dream of its last meal and await its next victim.
Burl made his way to a point where the tunnel was just 10 feet away. Soon, through the threads of the tunnel, he saw the thick, gray bulk of the spider return to its resting place. Burl's hair stood on end from sheer fright, but he was slave to an idea. He drew near and aimed his deadly pointed spear at the bulge in the tunnel where the spider lay. He thrust it home with all his strength and ran away at top speed, glassy-eyed from terror. Much later, he ventured near again, heart still in his mouth, ready to flee at the slightest sound. All was still.
Burl had missed the horrible convulsions of the wounded spider, had not heard the frightful gnashings of its fangs against the piercing weapon, had not seen the silken threads of the tunnel ripped as the mortally wounded spider struggled madly to free itself.
Exultation filled Burl's heart. His pride had been furtive vermin for thousands of years, hiding or fleeing from mighty insects, and if overtaken, screaming shrilly in terror while helplessly awaiting death. Burl had turned the tables. He had slain an enemy of his tribe. His breast expanded. Always his tribesmen went quietly and fearfully, but a sudden exultant yell burst from Burl's lips. The first hunting cry from the lips of a man in 300 centuries. The next second his pulse nearly stopped in sheer panic at having made such a noise. He listened apprehensively, but there was no sound. He approached his prey and carefully withdrew his spear. The viscous liquid made it slimy and slippery. He wiped it dry against a leathery toadstool. Then Burl had to conquer his illogical fear again before daring to touch the creature he had slain. He moved off presently, with the belly of the spider on his back and two hairy legs over his shoulders. The other limbs hung limp, trailing on the ground.
Burl was now a still more curious sight, wrapped in a shining cloak of iridescent colors, wearing a headdress of golden antennae, and hauling the hideous bulk of a gray spider. He moved through the mushroom forest, and because of the thing he carried, all creatures fled before him. They did not fear man. Their instinct was slow moving. But during all the millions of years that insects have existed, spiders have preyed upon them.
He passed the thicket in which great moths hid during the day, and the turgid pool of slime and yeast where a monster water snake lurked. He penetrated the little wood of shining mushrooms that produced light at night, and the shadowed place where truffle-hunting beetles went chirping thunderously at dark hours. Then Burl saw Saya.
A flash of pink skin vanishing behind the thick stalk of a squat toadstool.
He ran forward, calling her name.
She appeared, and saw the figure with the horrible bulk of the spider on its back. Horrified, she cried out.
And Burl understood. He dropped his burden, then went swiftly toward her. They met.
Saya waited timidly until she saw who this man was. And astonishment filled her face. Gorgeously attired in an iridescent cloak from the whole wing of a great moth, with a strip of softest fur from a night-flying creature about his middle, with golden feathery antennae bound on his forehead, and a fierce spear in his hands.
This was not the Burl she knew.
But he moved slowly toward her, filled with fierce delight at seeing her again, thrilling with joy at her slender gracefulness and the dark richness of her tangled hair. He held out his hands and touched her shyly. Then, manlike, he babbled on excitedly about his adventures and dragged her toward the great victim, the gray-bellied spider.
Saya trembled when she saw the furry bulk lying on the ground and almost fled when Burl advanced and took it on his back. But something of the pride that filled him came vicariously to her. She smiled a flashing smile.
And Burl stopped short in his explanation, tongue-tied. His eyes became pleadingly soft. He laid the huge spider at her feet and spread out his hands imploringly.
30,000 years of savagery had not lessened Saya's femininity.
She became aware that Burl was her slave. That these wonderful things he wore and had done meant nothing if she did not approve. She drew away. Saw the misery in Burl's face, and abruptly ran into his arms and clung to him, laughing happily.
And suddenly Burl understood that all these things he had done, even the slaying of a great spider, were of no importance whatever beside this most wonderful thing that had just happened, and told Saya so quite humbly, but holding her very close to him as he did.
And so Burl came back to his tribe. He had left nearly naked, with but a wisp of moth wing twisted about his middle, a timid, fearful, trembling creature. He returned triumphantly, walking slowly, fearlessly down a broad lane of golden mushrooms toward the hiding place of his people. On his shoulders was draped a great and many-colored cloak made from the whole of a moth's wing. Soft fur was about his middle, a spear was in his hand, a fierce club at his waist. He and Saya bore between them the dead body of a huge spider, aforetime the dread of the pink-skinned naked men.
But to Burl, the most important thing of all was that Saya walked beside him, openly, acknowledging him before all the tribe.
You have been listening to The Mad Planet by Murray Leinster. In the cast, you heard David Dukes as the storyteller, Daniel Passer as Burl, and Amanda Carr as Saya. The story was abridged for audio, produced, and directed by Yuri Rostovsky.